You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked-about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And with me today is Leslie Savoy Burrs, who is an award-winning performer, composer, and educator. This is our second of a two-part interview with Leslie. I hope you'll listen to the first one. There we got to discuss Leslie's early life and how it led to him creating almost a genre of music that we call urban classical. And we have a few examples of that played in that podcast. We also discuss how Leslie evolved as a performer to a composer now of operas that gave him a fuller range of opportunity to express the African-American experience and to work with other social good organizations and artists to do it. So I really hope you'll check into that episode. And in this episode, we're going to get into some of the tools that Leslie uses to actually create music that produces social good as well as enjoyable listening. So Leslie, welcome again for our second edition. So let's talk about some of the things you're involved in now. I understand you just got a commission out of Tennessee. Won't you talk about the I Can't Breathe project?
Yeah, this is a wonderful project that I'm involved with right now. I'm in the process of writing the music for. The librettist for this particular opera, I Can't Breathe, is Brandon G. Gibson. And the company is the Marble City Opera Company. And so they approached me. They took the responsibility when they saw these atrocities taking place with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others, Eric Garner, but particularly the moment that the George Floyd episode of murder took place, the head of the opera company, Catherine Frady, said, we have to do something about this. We have to make a statement. And so she approached Brandon, who is one of the administrators for the opera company, but is also an opera singer and a writer and a theatrical person, and said, can you write the libretto for this? And he took that responsibility to do so. And then they were trying to decide, well, how do we identify and secure the composer? And one of the board members was familiar with my work, and she happened to be also the voice teacher for my daughter at the University of Maryland. Her name is Dolores Ziegler, very prominent mezzo-soprano, who's sitting on the board. And she said, well, basically, she would like to recommend me, Leslie Burrs. And so they went on to hear my music and then extended the invitation for me to be commissioned by them to write this work. And I Can't Breathe is going to consist of six monodramas that will then culminate in this seventh scene for all the characters preceding the last scene. And each of those scenes contends with the varying aspects of how Blacks have lost their lives to unfortunate encounters with police and issues of brutality, and stressing it does not matter as long as you're Black. It does not matter if your background is a pedigree of the highest and best universities, or if your background is you're selling wares on the street legally, or if you're conducting yourself in a suit or in a hoodie. It doesn't matter. You can still be shot, because the one thing that's not different is the color of your skin. And so the librettist, Brandon Gibson, he cites in each monodrama that culminates as an opera, different life experiences that you'll be able to associate with what you know over the course of most recent history.
What are you doing musically there that you might share with us that brings that out?
You know, so one thing that I'm always attributing to my process for writing for operas is, one is identifying the rhythm of the text. So some people like to ask, does the music come first? For me, the words always come first, and they come first to the extent that once they're submitted to me, I delve into the rhythm of the words, the dramatic elements of what the text is conveying, and the texture and emotion of the text, and of the libretto. I try to capture those things, and then the inflection where it's representing the contours of sound when you say a word, like, you know, come on, man. You know, that's a beat on bomb. Come on, man. You know, you hear that, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, some mm-hmm. things of that nature, right? Or other phrases, you know. And so I'm listening for those contours. Again, that's texture to me. So then I go to find motivic concepts that are going to reinforce the essence of the scene itself, you know, things that can be, even if the librettist didn't imply that a text phrase should be repeated or something, I'll identify those things to help allow the audience to have a sense of a base of connection through the music with the, not necessarily repetition of the words per se, but where you come back to them and they become familiar to you in a way that it becomes this home base of security, of understanding the music. So that's how I approach writing the music for operas in general.
I wonder if you might also talk a bit about a work you did previously in this connection, because I think Vanqui leading up to I Can't Breathe, this seems to be like right in the middle of that, or at least in that whole stream. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece on voyeuristic absurdities from Mingus to Diallo. And I was really struck by something you said about that called be conscious of the eviction of life.
That's right. That's right.
And I thought that was really powerful. What were you feeling when you put that music together?
All right, so this voyeuristic absurdities from Mingus to Diallo is a chamber ensemble work. And I think it is important for us to be conscious of the full breadth of what I'm doing, from my flute music and solo flute music as an example of the smallest element of my writing to the largest, meaning opera. But in between those two ends of the spectrum are many different things, jazz big band music of mine, and then chamber music. And so the chamber ensemble from Philadelphia that's been in existence for, I think, close to 40 years is named Ray Losh. And Ray Losh approached me to commission me to write a new work. And so I was always impacted on the experience that took place with Amadou Diallo in New York City, where I think there were 19 bullet holes in him by the time these series of gunshots at him, for him reaching into his wallet to show his identification. But it was just an opportunity to go on a hunt to kill a black man for the day in New York at the time. I think that was in the 90s. And he had just basically got notification that he was graduating and things were going to move on. And he was notifying his family in Africa how thrilled he was for what his next steps were going to be. And they were looking for some black suspect, and he was convenient enough to be in a hall at his entrance to the doorway to his apartment building, and they opted just to fill him with bullets. And so that, and then on the flip side was me watching a documentary on the very famous jazz bassist Charles Mingus, and he being evicted from his apartment, and all of his stuff just taken out of his apartment and thrown on the sidewalk. And this is one of the greatest jazz musicians to ever walk on the planet. And here he was. So voyeuristic absurdities is the intent of reinforcing, witnessing how racism impacts us in so many different ways. And so we, as of this 2020, we premiered in reaction to Black Lives Matters and tribute to Black Lives Matters. Ray Lash created visuals to premiere this work as a music video for Heuristic Absurdities from Mingus to Diallo. So in the music, I'm portraying the impact these storylines, and these storylines represent Black people in general as opposed to just the two individuals. What happened to Diallo, that was in the 90s, and here we are in 2021, and none of that has changed. Any excuse to kill a Black person for sport, it seems to still be in existence and still acceptable. And so that title and that work carries through to this moment.
Yeah, I noticed you mentioned in Voyeuristic Absurdities from Mingus to Diallo that imagine that we're still living in a world where these kinds of things just happen, where we can essentially lynch a person at lunch, and that's sort of a sport, so to speak. That's an entertainment thing that we do.
While they eat lunch.
Right. While they eat lunch, yeah. So why do you write this? Why do you do this, Leslie? Why do you do this with your music?
You know, when I was growing up and then in the 60s, protest was taking place so much and through music, right? Through the John Coltranes and through the Last Poets and, oh man, we could do Archie Shepp, Pharoah Sanders, all of that. The phrase that struck me at that time and stays with me is, are you creating art for art's sake? And there's nothing wrong with that. But I made a conscious decision that I did not want to create art for art's sake. I saw that was not enough for me. Art had to get on with making a statement that would help represent, reflect, encourage thought to where we are in society at that given moment and for the future of society. And that became really crucial to me. And when we were talking earlier about aspirations of becoming a celebrity, sure, when I was a young guy, I wanted that kind of recognition, but there was a day that it hit me that I can't just play music just to be playing it and to make a dollar. The music has to reflect what is going on around me and how I'm interpreting what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing and what it's like to be a Black man, to be a Black woman, to step out in the street and jeopardize your life just because you're stepping out into the street, right? So how do you get all of that conveyed through your art so that it can help make a difference? And so from early on, my late teens to this day, one way or another, that's what I'm committing to in the work that I'm doing.
Yeah, and you had some early structures that you put together too to do some of that work, like the Creative Artist Workshop. Tell us a little bit about Creative Artist Workshop, where the inspiration for that came from.
When I decided I was going to start a nonprofit organization, first thing that was pointed out to me is you need a name for the organization. And so I was fumbling with one idea after another. And I decided, well, if I was to describe the project, I would say it's an organization for creative artists to have a creative artist workshop opportunity. And one of my mentors at the time was saying, well, there's your name right there, the Creative Artist Workshop. And so that became really apparent, and that became its own inspiration. And the intent for me starting the Creative Artist Workshop was to allow not only for an outlet for myself as an artist, but to provide these means of opportunity for other, at the time, minority artists. What I really was thinking was primarily for African-American artists and for artists who maybe were lacking, which we all were at the time, we were young, lacking name recognition and automatic ways of guaranteeing ticket sales and things of that nature, and also dedicating themselves to repertoire and to artistic ventures that weren't not necessarily the norm, but were very important. And so I decided I would like to see if I couldn't provide a platform for my other colleagues and people that I admired and wanted to work with as well. And so I thought the Creative Artist Workshop could really serve that function. And then I realized it could serve the function of both educational programming as well as performance opportunities. And that felt good, and it felt right for me. So it was one thing to say, okay, here we go. I'm going to start this organization. Next thing I had to do was identify a set of board of directors and then figure out, well, what are we going to do with this project? What are we going to do with the Creative Artists Workshop? How do we get going here? And it dawned on me, one of the things that I should try is to partner with the Philadelphia School District and see what could be done there. And at that time, the school district had a wonderful chapter of the Philadelphia Young Audiences. And so I was able to approach that chapter, the Philadelphia Young Audiences, and expressed interest and explained what we were in the process of wanting to provide for their programming. They found it intriguing, and so they definitely invited us and signed us on. And it turned out to be just a wonderful experience for many different reasons. And when the question about animating musical productions and the word empower really came into play, because what I realized was, first, I've got to get an ensemble together. And who would be in that ensemble? Of course, I wanted to get all the people that I had the highest admiration for if they were interested. So I went to the jazz musicians in Philadelphia at the time that I thought so well of, and probably didn't even know that well myself. But as I've stated earlier, my criteria standard was go for the best and go to them directly, as opposed to half-stepping or discouraging yourself from taking that chance. And so I approached the jazz artist that I was hoping would be interested in the project, and they were open to it. And so one of our first ventures as an organization, as a nonprofit, for the Creative Artists Workshop was to partner with the Philadelphia Chapter of Young Audiences. And ultimately, we did over 70 schools throughout the city of Philadelphia. And that meant that we did programming for thousands of children. And the thing that was so remarkable about all of that was it was one thing for us to bring the programming to the kids, and we're providing in that way. But the kids were providing for us absolute incentive. And the word that we'll probably be using throughout discussion today is they were inspirational to us as much as anything. The other thing that came out of that period and that sense of interacting with students and educational programming is we were inspired then to get on with creating a summer music camp. And that was really a very, very special experience. We took 3 weeks of a summer and identified kids from all walks of life and presented different aspects of music, from African drumming to music theory to vocal lessons to instrumental lessons. It really was a very good program. We were focusing on bringing to the Philadelphia public the contributions of artists that may not have been household names, but were impacting internationally, impacting in many different ways with their art forms. We invited William L. Dawson, a great composer, to come and work with Creative Artists Workshop. And Mr. Dawson consented. And so he came and he worked with the Mendelssohn Singers through the efforts of Creative Artists Workshop. And I'm stressing that because the Mendelssohn Singers were primarily a white organization doing primarily classical, quote unquote, classical music. And Mr. Dawson is very highly revered as a composer and arranger, particularly of what most would call a Negro spirituals. Mr. Dawson is somewhat emphatic at saying what are usually called spirituals, he feels should be called Negro folk songs, because he felt not only had a spiritual meaning religious context, but as importantly, I'll say, that the concept of Negro folk songs is the embodiment of these works representing a race of people. And Mr. Dawson took great pride in the concept of Negro. And frankly, for him and for my interpretation of how he feels about that, to me, there's no difference between his use of that word and the concept of what we say for as African Americans today, he himself epitomized the essence of the African American race, as well as, from his perspective, the Negro race. And the folk songs, again, are the embodiment of who and what we are as a race. Like he would point out, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. He's saying he felt the real title is Nobody Knows the Trouble I See. Because if you think about that as a race, we're not just looking behind us to see what has transpired or impacted on us as a race more times than not in a negative context. But it's nobody knows the trouble I see because we're living it on a daily basis. And I think that's an important distinction. So he also pointed out, because they're Negro folk songs, does that mean that they are meant to be sung exclusively by Negroes only or African Americans only? And that was a really eye-opening revelation for me, because the Mendelssohn Singers, which was a very large and very successful and respected choral ensemble, were thrilled to have the opportunity to sing under the direction of William L. Dawson. What Mr. Dawson explained to them and to me, and what we witnessed, is that the folk songs of the Negro race, of the African American race, are meant to represent all people. But they emanate from the life experiences of those creating the folk songs. But he said that doesn't mean that others cannot be taught them and to then help to better understand the purpose and function of what these folk songs / spirituals really mean. And I watched him conduct and help shape and mold this choir, and with them being thrilled to be shaped and molded by him to create a wonderful musical experience. And that was one of the first Creative Artist Workshop presentations for us. And we gave it at the Academy of Music Hall, which was, again, next door to the main Academy of Music, the big hall with the orchestra. But that's what we could afford. And it was a beautiful setting. And the music was just so well received and so well executed by the Mendelssohn Singers because of the direction that Mr. Dawson gave them of his compositions and arrangements. After the William L. Dawson presentation, we were wondering, what's our next program now? And we decided on The Sound of Brown. And The Sound of Brown was meant to represent the sounds of poetry by the poet Sterling A. Brown. And the sounds would be me as the composer creating new works as they influenced my perception of the sounds. As one person would say, the sounds that I was hearing based on the poetry. And so I created a series of a number of pieces of musical works based on a set of poems by Sterling A. Brown. And one of those that I'm very proud of is titled Mill Mountain. And Mill Mountain is a real place. It's, I'm pretty sure, in Roanoke, Virginia. And Sterling, in his poetry, decided he wanted to express his feelings of going to the top of Mill Mountain with one of his colleagues who happened to be female and he thought pretty well of. And he used the poem to show just, frankly, how smart he was, or thought he was, pontificating on varying things. And he thought she was just completely enamored with how and what he was saying until he looked down and realized she had fallen asleep. And so I thought it was such a beautiful poem. And I had tremendous difficulty trying to figure out, how do I start the music for this piece? Because even though it was poetry, I was not creating works that involved lyrics representing the poetry. So it was all instrumental music. And so I started thinking, I said, you know, maybe with Mill Mountain, I since I'm not sure how to start, what would happen if I just imagined creating a melody to the opening words? Now, I can't recite the poem verbatim, but the words had a rhythm to them that opened where it said, the moon is a lantern set by an old truant shepherd, to light up the fields. And I used those words, and I literally put notes to those words to help me get the piece started. And that worked perfectly for me. And so when you hear the opening of Mill Mountain, those words are going in my mind. The notes are basically representing that text. And then I went on to do what they call text painting and was able to, from that point on, imagine what Sterling was talking about in the poem and have the music reflect that. So Mill Mountain is one of my, just one of the pieces I'm very, very pleased with.
So Leslie, you know, we're coming to the end of this, but I also wanted to talk about Opera North just a little bit, and because I think it's important for people in the music world to understand that there are other ways to achieve social goals, but they need to understand the structures and ways of going about that. You had to sort of feel your way through it. But you've left now, I think, a model and approach for others to do likewise, for people who don't necessarily want to follow the path of record labels and so forth, to be able to organize in such a way that they can get support from a community of people who matter and who matter to them.
Art, this is a very important question that you raise about how I use nonprofit tools to animate musical and artistic projects and to empower people. You know, my first response is that I use the nonprofit world to help to animate my career and to empower me. I realized that when I was getting out of the University of the Arts and then coming out of the Business of Music course, you know, I was expressing how I wasn't sure which direction I was going to go or anything like that. But then it came to me that, man, I learned about nonprofits, and I think nonprofits might open up a new world for me. And I thought, I better explore this and see what happens. And so that's exactly what I did. And, you know, by doing it, it gave me a sense of confidence, and it gave me a sense of curiosity, and wanted me to it gave me the opportunity to see how far can I go with this, man? And so I had to take my first steps. And that's what I did, was to begin by starting a nonprofit to motivate myself, to empower myself, and, you know, to animate my dreams. But part of that was to be able to allow for interactions with people that I've always imagined I'd wanted to work with, which we discussed a little in the previous segment. And all of this just started clicking for me. It started making sense that let's try this nonprofit route and see what happens.
I think the Opera North in particular was another, I think, brainchild of yours that helped bring some of that work to light, bring some of your work to light. And it's a structure that people should know about.
Okay. So I do not take credit for, I'm and the administrator for Opera North from basically the year 2000 to now, but they were in existence 20 years at least. Opera North has been in existence for 40 plus years. They were originally created because there was no outlet for the African-American opera singer to do standard opera repertoire. And Opera North took on the responsibility of providing opportunities and production and performance outlets for the African-American opera singer. Opera North, Inc. became aware of me because they wanted to do a version of Vanquish in the year around 2000. So they approached me, and they approached me where they asked, could they do it? And I said, of course. But they had very limited funds, and so we had to figure out what to do about that. And the one thing that I assumed the responsibility of helping to find funding to allow Opera North, Inc. to put on a concert version of Vanqui. And out of that experience, the board took a liking to me and felt it would assist their organization if I would consider becoming an administrator for them. And they were inspired by that, by the organizational skills and fundraising skills I demonstrated at the time. So I opted to involve myself in that capacity with them. And from that, by becoming originally the artistic director and then the executive director, we've created new programming. They had opera in the schools all along, but we've enhanced that and elevated that. I came up with the ideas of jazz goes to the opera, opera in the libraries. So there's these different programs. As of this moment, right now, my daughter and I have just completed our first virtual video for Opera North that will be titled The Bamboo Man and the Drinking Gourd. And so we're creating these virtual videos to share with school districts representing Opera North singers and storylines and things of that nature. So that's where we are right now. And Opera North has stayed committed. There, in this day and age, there's many more opportunities for African-American artists to participate and perform in major opera companies. There's no getting around that. But we are creating repertoire and content that unique as a contributing component to the world of opera as well. So we're taking pride in that, and it helps to distinguish who we are, and it still has a focus on the African-American contribution to culture and society, but not exclusively to African-American performers, but with an emphasis on that.
Leslie, it seems that each time you become engaged with a new nonprofit endeavor, it opens up unexpected doors to entirely new ventures.
I was very fortunate to do some interesting projects, and one of them was creating a new opera, Transition Sung Stories, which was in conjunction with New Cortland Elder Services, and collecting oral histories and then converting it into an opera. And that went really, really well. But because I did that, I was approached by a friend of mine who is a psychologist. And he said, you know, I'm wondering if you could take the process you use for the collecting of the oral histories and all and adapt them to the idea of working in the field of substance abuse and mental health. And I said, of course, I would love to try to do that. And so he coordinated a meeting for me to meet with Dr. Arthur C. Evans, who was then the commissioner of the Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. And so we sat with my friend Bruce Zahn, a psychologist. He and Dr. Evans and Dr. Evans' team, we sat and started exploring what could be accomplished with bringing music to the experience of mental health and substance abuse. And so I recommended that we make use of one of my compositions, which was also a poem of mine called Autumn Journey. And so we decided that Autumn Journey would allow for the exploration of self-awareness and self-beauty. And so we took that work and identified a number of people who were involved with the Department of Behavioral Health and had them read the poem and then respond to the poem. And in responding, we were able to find out new things about how we could approach and create a new design for the issues of stigma reduction and many other aspects related to mental health concerns and substance abuse. And we took the poem and I created a new composition for orchestra and choir that was making use of the same title of Autumn Journey, and used that work and had those associated with the Department of Behavioral Health and were being assisted with the Department of Behavioral Health analyze the music and the reactions to that as well. And then not only did we have the music done, but we created a documentary film. And that film can be found, it's on my website, as a matter of fact, and it's on Vimeo as well. And it's called Autumn Journey. And it was successful enough that it was nominated for a film award. It did not win the award, but it was nominated, and this was a national film competition. And we were so proud of that fact as well. But the Autumn Journey Project just proved to be a very successful approach, giving consideration of combining the arts and the issues of mental health and substance abuse.
Leslie, you never stop innovating. You never stop trying new things and educating young people. Can you briefly share something from your experience with the Artist in Residency program?
You know, Art, you pointed out to me that there's so many different ways to make use of the ideas of giving and to make use of the nonprofit world in ways that giving becomes part of an artistic experience as much as a funding or financial contribution. And you also pointed out that there are other ways to be giving. And you mentioned to me the idea of how I've made use of becoming an artist in residence, which I've been very successful at over the course of years. And it's taken me all across the country. But one of my first artist in residence programs happened to be in York, Pennsylvania, for the school district of York, Pennsylvania. And it was one of the most, again, eye-opening experiences for me, in part because, one, I went there with the understanding that I was to inspire and I was to provide new insights for the kids that I'd be working with throughout the school district. And the first thing I found out is the kids were far more inspiring to me and providing me with new perspectives on how to grow as an artist as much as I was trying to give to them. And so here we are over the course of a school year, creating new works and writing works that were challenging the kids to the extent that music teachers were saying, "Oh, you're writing music that's too hard for these kids." They had multiple meters, you know, the polymeters and in 5/4 and 4/4, 3/4, and asking kids to sing in vocal ranges that normally they weren't asked to do. But all I learned is never underestimate the abilities of a child, of a student, of a teenager. Set the goal and see if they can reach the goal. And they not only reached them, but they've exceeded any and all expectations. And so one of the things that was an outcome with the Artists in Residence program, which happened to be funded by the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts at the time, allowed me to do something that I thought was going to be very important as an artist in residence and conveying this concept to the students about how to take the initiative to create your own opportunities. And that got demonstrated by us deciding we would make our own album and then use the album to represent the accomplishments of what took place that year with all the music. And so we created the album Carvings. It's one of my compositions. What they did for that album was so, it was beautiful. And they were all involved with not only creating the music, but also taking part in all the aspects of what it took to bring the physical elements, the design of the cover, the photography process for negotiating and securing the right fees for the pressing of the album. All of those things came into play with the residency project. Now, that residency took place in 1981-82. And I'm saying that for a very specific reason, because in 2020, out of nowhere, I got an email from Paris, France, asking, would it be possible for the record label that reached out to me to re-release the album Carvings that was done 40 years ago with high school kids? And it was the William Penn High School. Sometimes it's known as York High High School as well. But the William Penn High School Jazz Ensemble and the Artist in Residence Project, the gentleman who wrote me is the head of the record label. It's called Libreville Records in Paris. And they specialize in re-releasing a vinyl product. And so they want to have permission to re-release this album internationally. And he said the reason was because they fell in love with the album. So the tenacity, the ability, the endurance, all of those things, that all those great words of strength associated with these kids working hard when we were told that the music's going to be too hard for them to recreate and all. They make this beautiful album as teenagers. One of them, Tim Warfield, went on to become a very famous jazz saxophonist. 40 years later, here we are being invited to have the album be re-released to an international public. And I take so much pride in being associated not only with the product and with the project, but with those kids who created this music. And I thought that's just important to make sure that we understand just what can be accomplished with your work as an artist, and when you dedicate yourselves to yourself, to doing programming that's going to allow for people to grow in the process, and you grow as well.
Great. Leslie, I want to thank you so much for giving us now two episodes that we have to listen to and really understand what you're about, and how music and art can really drive social change from your perspective. You have been a stellar example of what an individual can do with music and art to make change in the world. And I hope that others listening to our podcast will emulate you and help all of us drive to a better world. Thank you very much, my friend, and thanks to all of our listeners. I hope you will listen to our next episode. Thanks for listening again to the Heart of Giving podcast.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only, and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.